This week began with the first Monday in October, set in law as the official opening of a new term of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Sheila Cast, and today, on Midday, we talk with two law professors about some of the most important cases facing the court and some of the arguments the nine justices will hear. Issues with wide impact, including race-based affirmative action in college admissions, mandatory fair share of union dues, one person, one vote, the death penalty, and abortion. After legalizing same-sex marriage and upholding Obamacare, is the High Court now poised to turn to the right? On Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us. The first Monday in October is set in law as the opening of the U.S. Supreme Court's term. So on today's show, we're going to look at some of the most significant cases the court has agreed to hear. Their decisions could make big changes in who gets admitted to college, who has to pay union dues, how available abortions are, how election districts are drawn, and even whether the death penalty continues to be used in the U.S. We'll also look at the tenor of the court. This year marks the beginning of the second decade of Chief Justice John Roberts' leadership of the court. Some of us were surprised when he led the court to uphold Obamacare in the last term. And, of course, the court ended its last term with a decision that legalized same-sex marriage in every state. What can we expect from the court this coming year? We've enlisted two law professors who regularly keep an eye on the court and its rulings to be our guides this hour. In the studio with us is Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's a contributing writer to The Atlantic Online as the magazine's Supreme Court correspondent. He's also a contributing editor of The American Prospect and author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Welcome.
Great to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And also with us is Mark Graber of the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. Professor Graber is the author of A New Introduction to American Constitutionalism, and he co-edited American Constitutionalism, Structures and Powers, and American Constitutionalism, Rights and Powers, both from Oxford University Press. Welcome to the show.
Greetings.
So the court's website says about 10,000 petitions are filed each term asking the court to hear a case. And I always mispronounce this word. Petitions for certiorari?
Certiorari.
Yeah. Okay. I'll let you pronounce it. At any rate, about how
we
many?
We just say cert and you're off.
Cert.
The...
Okay. I was showing off. Mm-hmm. About how many of those does the court actually end up hearing? In a typical
last term, it was 78 cases that were fully heard, briefed, and decided. I would say between there and 90 is the average. And that number has been going down year by year for the past 30 years. The court's workload used to be nearly twice as heavy.
So how many have they agreed to so far this year? I mean, have they set most of those?
No. In fact, it's only about 25 to 30, as far as I could figure out from the website this morning, which means a fair probability will be that the three of the four biggest cases of the term, we don't know yet.
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes. Because it all depends on when the petitions come in. They granted review in 13 petitions a week ago Thursday because they came in over the summer, and the justices come back from their vacations and look at this big pile of petitions. But a lot of petitions still are yet to come in, as like in the abortion case or, you know.
Yeah, there are probably three hot-button issues that people have just gotten to the court or are about to get to the court. There are the abortion cases. There are the follow-up to the contraception Obamacare cases. And perhaps the sleeper issue is there are now a lot of Second Amendment cases that have been decided by the federal circuit courts that are ripe for Supreme Court review, and people are wondering when they're going to take one of those.
Also, Texas voter ID is floating around.
Texas voter ID.
Yeah. the very strict voter ID
law. Why don't we talk about that? Because we're going to talk about one man, one vote when we talk about districting. I'd like to start with college admissions, the whole idea of affirmative action, the Fisher versus University of Texas case. What's the issue there?
Well, this is a mysterious case that just keeps hanging around the Supreme Court, even though there is no actual case left and the plaintiff, Ms. Fisher, has graduated from college. But she applied to the University of Texas. She had a good record, but not top. She didn't get in, and then she brought suit saying that her constitutional rights had been violated because the University of Texas uses race to characterize admissions in a small number of cases, and this discriminated against her. Texas's program is very unusual. There isn't another one like it in the country because the top 10% of every high school in Texas is entitled to admission to the University of Texas. And that produces a substantial amount of diversity in their entering class, but they use race to get few more, to get what they call critical mass. The case came before the court 2 terms ago, and the court said, well, we're not going to strike down affirmative action, but we don't think the Court of Appeals applied the right standard. Go back and apply the right standard. The Court of Appeals applied the right standard, and they said, once again, we think this program's fine. It was a surprise when the court granted review the second time. Somebody wants to do something with this case, and we don't really know what it is.
Okay, because I was wondering why it's not settled law if the Supreme Court... I mean, so the case, in your view, has not substantially changed since the last time it was before the court.
No, and, you know, last time, apparently, according to Joan Biskupic, the court was poised to strike...
Joan Biskupic, who covers the court.
...for Reuters Thompson and wrote a biography of Justice Sotomayor. The court was poised 5-4 to do away with affirmative action, but Justice Sotomayor wrote a dissent that was so personal and intense that a bargain was struck in which they would narrow it but not strike it down. Mark?
Well, I think one of the things to remember is that Grutter upheld affirmative action in 2003 with respect to the University of Michigan by a 5-4 vote, but one of the crucial votes, Justice O'Connor, is off the court, replaced by Justice Roberts, and these are five justices who have not seen an affirmative action program they like. And so in many ways, the major question isn't how they're going to vote in Fisher, but whether, one, they're simply going to say, well, the particular details of this program are unconstitutional, but maybe you can run a constitutional affirmative action program. We're not going to say, come back to us in a few years, who knows? Or whether they're going to say it is virtually impossible, if not impossible, to have an affirmative action program in college admissions.
So in that case, they'd be turning over. I mean, essentially every college that has an affirmative action program would have to say, we're on notice that if somebody challenges this, we're probably going to lose.
Yeah. Every college which has an affirmative action program, meaning about every college.
Yeah, and the question is whether they would just say Grutter is hereby reversed. My guess is that Justice Kennedy will not go for that. He's just narrowing and narrowing and narrowing, and they may strike down the Texas program without speaking to the issue nationally.
That's Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law here on Midday on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast, and also with us is Mark Graber of the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. We're talking about cases that will be before the Supreme Court this coming term, and you are welcome to join this conversation. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can call long distance at 1-866-661-9209, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'd like you to be part of this conversation. I wanted another case and another issue. It just happens to also involve a teacher, so I think of it as an education case, but it's really a union case, and that is Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. I mean, most of us, our whole professional lives, when we think about unions, it's been governed by a 1977 case in which the compromise seemed pretty logical to me. Tell us about that case first before we talk about the case that's before the Supreme Court.
Well, what we have is a doctrine which is union dues can be required. A state can have something that's called a closed shop law. That is, if you have a certain kind of job, you must belong to the union. You must belong to the union and pay the union dues. Now, some unions engage in lots of politics. So the rule is you have to segregate the fund that is specifically for politics. So your dues, as they say, you don't want to be in the union, your dues go to help the collective bargaining. But if the union has a segregated fund, that's okay. You may not have to contribute to it.
So in other words, you pay for the negotiating on your behalf, but you don't have to pay for the lobbying and the political stuff.
Exactly.
You don't
it's called an agency fee. And the 1977 case you referred to is called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And in that case, the court said, we can't allow people to benefit because unions are required to represent
everyone
in
yes.
their bargaining unit, whether they're members or not. And these people are not members. But we can't allow these people to benefit from very hard work that is done not only in collective bargaining, but in resolving grievances and benefits and so forth. Unions do work very hard. We won't allow them to be free riders, which is the term. And, mm-hmm. and Justice Scalia, in a later opinion, endorsed this rationale. Now, under the prodding of Justice Alito, who is absolutely just rabid on the subject of public employees' unions, the court is now drawing near a decision that agency fees violate the First Amendment. It would be a reversal of Abood. It would be quite a radical blow to public employees' unions in this country.
Explain to me why this would apply just to public employee unions.
Well, because the First Amendment calculation is quite different in a private in private employment. Your employer can require you to give up a lot of your First Amendment rights on the job. But when the government is the employer, the First Amendment applies with full force against it. And so they say that the argument is that paying for political activities is government-compelled speech. And once you call it government-compelled speech, you know, as Mark knows, that puts you in the dead zone because the government can't make me say the Pledge of Allegiance. It can't make us say how much we love America. That's a violation of the First Amendment. So if that's what it is, then public employee unionism is in serious trouble.
Though, as with all cases, the opinions really matter. Mm-hmm. So again, you could imagine, well, there's something a little wrong with the California law. Another opinion that says you can't do this for public employee unions. But you can even have an opinion that says when you have a closed shop, by state law, the state law can't mandate that people actually pay dues. They have to belong to the union, not pay dues. And you can see a freedom of association case down the road that declares closed shops unconstitutional. We are not there yet, but there's a drift. I think one of the features of everything the Supreme Court decides settles some things and unsettles others.
But it's important to note that this case in particular is teed up to the court. It's a highly ideological case. It was presented to the court by a group of people who said, we want the court to overturn Abood. And when they went into the lower courts, they just said, we're not even going to argue that this program, that we win unless Abood is overturned. And Justice Alito has written some very hostile opinions about public employee unions and it seems to me that if there are five votes to gut public employee unionism, this is the time it will happen.
But you have pointed particularly to Justice Alito. What's your reading of the other eight justices? Have they shown their hand on where they are on this issue?
Yeah, well, there have been 2-5-4 decisions against the public employee unions. And Justice Kennedy, who, you know, we sometimes fondly look to as a potential moderate, is very clearly convinced from comments he's made that public employee unions are a kind of malign force in our nation's life, that they're pushing for big government, that they're expanding. You know, he sees us as living in a kind of big government dystopia. So it's hard for me to see who would switch when the issue is cleanly presented. It wasn't cleanly presented in the last case. This one does.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Garrett Epps and Mark Graber about some of the high-profile cases to be argued before the Supreme Court in its new term that started Monday. And we'd like you to be part of the conversation. We'd welcome your calls at 410-662-8780. We'd welcome an email at midday@wypr.org. What do you think about some of these big issues? Stay with us. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. On today's show, we're talking about the new term of the Supreme Court. We've got two very smart lawyers with us, Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law and Mark Graber.
And us.
I'm sorry? What?
Two smart lawyers and us.
Shh. I'm introducing you. Yeah. Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law, Mark Graber of the University of Maryland School of Law. And we're talking about the Supreme Court, as I said. Court watchers say that it's likely to look at the death penalty this term. What will tee that up?
Well, we've already got a number of cases that have been granted review, and in fact, this week the court heard the first two. They're by far not the most important ones. They have to do with a relatively unusual holding by the Kansas Supreme Court. But what everybody was watching for when those two cases came before the court yesterday was whether any of this bad feeling from last term was still floating around the court. And there's a way in which the justices were angrier at each other about the death penalty than they were about same-sex marriage. And you could see it on the bench.
Oh, tell me.
Justice Breyer, writing for himself, and Justice Ginsburg at the end of the term issued a dissent where he said, "I have just concluded the death penalty is always unconstitutional." On the other side, we had Justice Alito saying there's been a guerrilla war against the death penalty. The death penalty, there must be a way. States must be able to. I mean, it's almost crossed the line into advocacy. And usually when the justices come back in the fall, they've had time to cool out. They basically like each other. But there's still a little bit of snark going on because at some point yesterday, Justice Scalia said, "Well, it sounds like Kansans, unlike Justice Breyer, are fond of the death penalty," and Breyer's chuckling over there. But the needle was already out, and in the first week in the term, that's kind of unusual.
Well, what's going on in this term is a continuation of what we might consider constitutional trench warfare. The issues are not big, both in the sense of the court is not considering the constitutionality of the death penalty, nor is it the case that if we look at the issues presented, any one opinion will either make sure lots of people get executed or, in fact, take lots of people off death row. Rather, what the court has been doing is taking small issues, and one looks for trends. So a number of years ago, there was a slight trend towards finding the death penalty unconstitutional in circumstances. Now maybe the trend is running the other way. So two cases to watch for. First comes out of Florida. In Florida, unlike any other state, the jury does not decide the ultimate issue of death. The judge does. The jury serves as an advisor to the judge. There's a question now as to whether that is constitutional, as to given if death is something additional in a separate proceeding, it may have to be decided by the jury. There's some recent case law on that, but notice this case is limited to Florida because in every other state, the jury verdict death is final. Here, the jury simply says, "We think, Your Honor, you ought to do death or you ought to do life imprisonment," but the judge may independently decide. The second case is a case that is unique on its facts, at least on its discovered facts. It comes out of Georgia. In the original trial, the prosecutor challenged every African American on the jury. And prosecutors are allowed to exercise something called peremptory challenges. That is, you get about 12 to 18, where I can simply say, "You know, Garrett, you're wearing a shirt I don't like. You're off the jury."
You don't even have to mention the shirt. You just throw him off the jury.
I don't like you.
I just, you know, you're looking at me the wrong way. Now, a great many times it's happens that when an African American is accused of murder, particularly an African American is accused of murder of a white person, it just turns out that the prosecutor doesn't like the way any potential African American looks at. There is something then called a Batson hearing after a case called Batson versus Kentucky, where the prosecutor must at least give a race-neutral reason. Now, it usually turns out this is good enough. No, I didn't like the way he was looking at me, or she was looking at me. But in this case, after the Batson hearing took place and the person was sentenced to death, someone discovered the prosecutor's notes. And the prosecutor's notes circled race and literally, you know, quite said, get this person off the jury. If there has to be one African American on the jury, I guess it's that one. The Georgia Supreme Court said, well, we don't see how this affects things, to which a great many people thought, no, this is wrong. Now, the real issue here, I suspect this case is sufficiently horrible that, in fact, the Supreme Court will reverse on its facts. But there is a great deal of evidence that prosecutors are striking African Americans from juries and are allowed to get away with it because the standard they must establish for a non-racial thing is so low, it is impossible not to establish unless you literally wrote down on a piece of paper, I'm challenging because black, put the piece of paper in your pocket, there was a hole in your pocket, and the defense discovered it. Maybe 25% chance of victory in that case. Might it be the case that Justice Kennedy, who does not like peremptory challenges, might join the four liberals in raising the standard for when African Americans are struck for juries? If there is a bigger liberal victory on the court this term, this one may be it.
Well, let me make sure I understand, but let me first remind people you can be part of this conversation. If you've got some concerns about what the Supreme Court may be deciding about the death penalty or any of these other issues we're talking about, give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. When you say the court may raise the standards, that is not something that would need legislation. That's something the court could say. You actually have to give a reason when you're striking an African American.
Yes, this is because it's Sixth Amendment, right to a, you know, Sixth and 14th Amendment, right to a, you know, a fair jury that fairly represents the community. So while we have peremptory challenges, the Constitution forbids peremptory challenges for being used for racial reasons.
And now, so the court could define what that means or how we know it when we see it.
Yeah, that's the crucial question, is how do we go about it? So one version, if you strike every African American off a jury, there is a presumption you use race. If there is a presumption you use race, probably your efforts will fail, particularly if it's a strong presumption. If any reason you give that is non-racial is okay as long as it passed a very weak laugh test, well, I can always say, I don't like the way this person is looking at me. You know, we just don't seem to have a good rapport
today. They use reasons like he was too old, she was too young, he seemed to be, you know, sort of overeducated, she didn't seem like she could follow. They're really extraordinary and self-contradictory.
But you began this wonderful exposition, Mark, by saying not very big issues. And you've sort of laid out the narrowness of some of these cases. But, Garrett, you said that two of the justices have said they think the death penalty may never be constitutional. So in that context, why do we think that perhaps that they actually won't talk about striking down the whole death penalty?
Well, the issue is not in front of the court this time. There is no case that I'm aware of that even in an alternative way says, and the death penalty is unconstitutional. Mark is right. They're fine-tuning how it works. Do you see one that could take us into a bigger...
It's hard to say because it's always the proviso. Mm. Once upon a time, about 50 years ago, there was a minor obscenity case before the Supreme Court. Everybody thought it was a minor obscenity case. Instead, the justices on their own use this case to announce the exclusionary rule would apply to state governments.
And I guess it's those cases where the justices do something. Stick with us non-lawyers. Yeah. We think that happens all the time because those are the ones we hear about.
You never know, because while in theory justices are supposed to decide only on the issues argued by the lawyers, they have the right to decide on any basis at all. So there are a number of cases. The Citizens United campaign finance case, the lawyers came in and said, we're not covered by the statute. The Supreme Court said, we don't care what you argued. We think the statute is unconstitutional. They can do that. We just don't know in what cases they're going to do that. Oral argument is sometimes a hint. Where the oral argument, I think you attended, so Garrett will know more, it seemed to me the justices were sticking with the issues as presented.
Yeah, I'm a lawyer, and so math isn't my strong suit, but I can't count to five votes to reexamine the constitutionality of the death penalty this term. I think they are minded to look at the details of each case, and Justice Kagan in particular was very much involved with the record and the very narrow issue, and I didn't hear, except for Scalia needling Breyer, I didn't hear any discussion of the larger issue.
Okay. I'd like to, by the way, I'm here with Mark Graber of the University of Maryland Law School and Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law. We're talking about the Supreme Court upcoming term, or the term that's actually already started, and you can be part of the conversation if you give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. There's going to be a discussion of one person, one vote, and how districts are drawn. Tell me about Evenwell versus Abbott.
Well, this is the opposite of the death penalty cases. In this case, this is a potentially huge case, and it's a case in which conservative advocacy groups are swinging for the fences. They want a home run. Because their argument is that one person, one vote, which comes from a series of cases in the 1960s, means, you know, it's like the Inigo Montoya thing. They suddenly say, you keep using that term, I don't think it means what you think it means. What they say is districts have to be drawn on the basis of actual voters. Now, until now, it has been presumed in most places, and certainly in parts of the Constitution, that districts are drawn on the population. Everyone who lives in a district and who is counted by the census counts when you try to create roughly equal districts for legislatures or members of Congress. There's a conservative group, Project on Fair Representation. They've challenged Texas's apportionment because they say, no, it should only be eligible voters. Non-citizens shouldn't count. Even perhaps felons shouldn't count. And if the court were to adopt that rule, it would move power radically and very fast in the Southwest out of the hands of Latinos and African Americans into the hands of white Republicans.
Well, I'm having a hard time grasping this. I mean, I can understand from a standpoint of planning a political campaign that candidates and elected officials would be very interested to know how many voters are in that district. But in terms of the obligation of an elected official to represent the people in that district, he or she has to represent the non-citizens, the children, the felons. I mean, I don't quite understand why they would not count when you're trying to figure out how many people are in this district.
Even more basic, if you are an originalist who actually cares a little bit about history, the issue came up in Congress when considering the 14th Amendment, and Section 2 deals with voting. And there was a big fight about voters and population. And population won out for a very simple reason, which is a number of states were moving towards including women. And if you reapportioned, say, congressmen on the basis of voters, well, that would give a strong incentive to many states to enfranchise women, because you could basically double your number of representatives, basically double your electoral vote. And so, in fact, when they say argument. Population was chosen precisely that we didn't want states to have incentives for women. But the end of the line, if you're an originalist, well, the framers fought over this issue. The framers clearly decided this issue. There's nothing more to talk about, to the point where the lower court opinion, I have to excerpt opinions for a casebook. I'm waiting for a 50-page opinion. It's 5 pages, and most of it, here are the facts of the case. Isn't this obvious? I don't think anyone thought the Supreme Court would take it.
So then that raises the question, who was the mover?
Well, yes,
which,
and no.
Why is it before the court?
Yes and no. Let's remember, this case is not coming to the court on writ of certiorari. It is not a discretionary case. This is called a direct appeal. The court has to decide it. Now, it always has the option of saying,
it's a direct appeal because?
Because the statute setting up these courts to hear redistricting challenges says there will be direct appeal to the Supreme Court. Congress can always do that.
I see.
So the court has to review this decision. It could do it in summary fashion and simply say appeal dismissed, or it could summarily affirm. But no matter what it does, it's setting a precedent. So if there are justices inside the court who think we ought to deal with this issue and settle it, then it makes sense that they would put it down for briefing, because if it were a certiorari case, they could just say writ denied and there would be no precedent set. But they're going to set a precedent no matter what they do. The other thing I think that's important, following up on what Mark said, is the challengers in this case, they don't have history on their side, and they keep saying this case arises under one person, one vote, which does not appear in the Constitution. And in fact, the provision of the Constitution this case concerns is the Equal Protection Clause, which says all persons. So they're having to tap dance their way around a lot of history and precedent. And the other thing, the reason I think they may not win, is because they can't figure out what should be used. And their brief says, well, the court needn't concern itself with implementation. That can be worked out later. And justices really don't like to hear that, because that means there's going to be a dozen cases coming back if you decide our way.
Well, this one is fascinating to me, and I'd love to hear from some of our listeners what they think of it. We're going to take a break here. That gives you time to call 410-662-8780, and we'll take some calls when we get back. I'm here with Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law and with Mark Graber of the University of Maryland School of Law, and we're talking about the Supreme Court. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Supreme Court session that started, the Supreme Court term that started this week. We're waiting for you to call us at 410-662-8780 or to send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm here with two law professors who keep an eye on the Supreme Court, Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law and Mark Graber of the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. Let me ask you about, there are some Second Amendment cases that we're expecting, correct?
At least there are Second Amendment cases that are now coming before the court. The justices have the option of taking them or not, so they're not coming on direct appeal that Garrett just spoke about. But, for example, in Heller in 2008, the Supreme Court said you have a constitutional right to have a handgun in your house. Well, do you have a constitutional right to have multiple handguns in your house? We've just had a decision from a circuit court saying you do. I presume everyone will appeal to the Supreme Court. The court in Heller laid down no standard. It simply said, well, having a handgun in your house is so basic to the right, that's clearly in, but we're not going to tell you what is out. At some point, given how much litigation there has been, the court is going to have to tell us, you know, what's the standard that we tell in from out. So multiple handguns, what weapons, when can you carry a weapon to your workplace? If you can have a weapon at home, can you have a weapon in your private workplace? We don't know. The courts are deciding. And importantly, they're disagreeing. So when lower courts disagree, usually Supreme Court considers, because we don't want a circumstance where you can have four guns in your living room in Maryland, three in Delaware, one in New York, and only in your bedroom, etc.
Gotcha. We have Spencer calling us from Baltimore. Spencer, welcome to Midday.
Hi, yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I wanted to comment on the apparent political nature of the Supreme Court in these days. It seems you can predict how any one of the justices will vote based solely on the political implications of the case.
And the political, are you saying... I want to make sure I'm understanding you. You're saying the political implications of the case, or by looking at the record of the judge?
Yeah, well, I mean, for example, like, Justice Alito or Justice Scalia, they will always fall on the conservative side of any case. And then the same thing can be said about, you know, some of the liberal judges.
Well, somebody could say that's not political, that's ideological, which isn't quite the same thing. What do you think about it, Garrett?
I think the most important piece of evidence that needs to be considered, because there's no question this court has polarized between conservatives and moderate liberals. But remember that in the case with the biggest partisan stakes last term, which is King versus Burwell, the Obamacare case, the Chief Justice, who, despite what anyone says, is a very conservative jurist, crossed over because I believe he read the statute in the way the administration wanted it read. I think there was no ulterior motive. And so, you know, I think if you follow the decisions day by day, there's no question. Justice Alito is very conservative. Justice Thomas is very conservative. Justice Scalia is very conservative. But they cross. Justice Scalia will cross on Fourth Amendment cases. Justice Thomas crossed over in the Confederate license plate case. So I don't really think you can predict with 100% accuracy based on the political valence of the case. Mark, you're a political scientist, right?
Judging the Supreme Court simply by decisions is a little more complicated because, in fact, what the Supreme Court gets are the borderline cases. They're the cases in which lots of people disagree over the right result, where, in fact, the law is not clear. So there is, in some sense, when the law is not clear, the law can't decide things. What is more interesting is how much law the justices leave alone. So they debate capital punishment. But I'll bet many of the liberals on the Supreme Court think a lot of punishment in the United States is too severe, but they don't have a plausible argument that it's cruel and unusual. So while they think death is cruel and unusual, lots of other excessive punishments they leave alone. When a state bans capital punishment, Scalia thinks they've made a horrible mistake, but since there is no constitutional provision that forbids lesser punishment than warranted, Scalia says, well, you've made a mistake, but I can't interfere. So there's more law going on than might seem from first appearances if you just look at division of votes.
Spencer, I appreciate your calling us. I want to move to Ezra in Dundalk, who has a point about reapportionment of House seats, seats for members of Congress based on population. Ezra, welcome to the show.
Yes, ma'am. That was so I had heard other places that if that case went that way, that it wouldn't just reapportion the House seats, but reapportion the federal money going into different districts by population, or not by population, but by number of voters. If they did it, and it initially would make the conservative side have a lot more representation and money, wouldn't that immediately flip when the liberal states just automatically registered all adults as voters and maybe even down to 16-year-olds? Wouldn't that just flip the whole thing?
You know, I don't think so. And the reason is that the basis that seems most likely to come out is not actual registered voters, but number of eligible voters. And, you know, your voting laws don't really change that very much. The only group of citizens that as a group is excluded from eligible voters are felons. And some states enfranchise felons more readily than others. So at the margin, you might have that happen. But otherwise, I think the result just is there in the census figures. And one of the problems they have is the census doesn't tell us who's a citizen and who isn't. They don't collect data on that. So this is a reason the justices may hesitate: is how do we, if we rule for you, how do we make this work? And the appellants have said, we don't know either. We'll work it out later.
One should also note that apportionment of representations or representatives between states, that is population.
Absolutely.
So, in fact, the mere fact that New York has more people than Maryland means New York gets more representatives, even if it turns out more people actually vote in Maryland. So all this case is about is apportioning districts within a state.
Right. And, of course, then you have, you know, the Senate, the U.S. Senate, which has nothing to do with one man, one vote. It's right. Entirely by district. And we have another point about one man, one vote from Marcia in Pikesville. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. I wanted to go back all the way to the framing of the Constitution, where there were debates about how would you count the slaves, and they were going to be three-fifths of a vote. So it seems to me that they meant that everybody else besides the slaves was going to be one counted as one person.
Every other male.
Every person. Because they set up the census at the time that they set up the shortly after they set up the Constitution.
In both provisions of the Constitution that govern the apportionment of representatives that Mark was talking about, they say respective numbers, which means all human beings.
Okay, but then that seems to me to underscore then your earlier point, Mark, that when Congress was setting things up, they did not expect it to be limited to voters, because if they were counting women in and they were not envisioning women as voters, then they weren't expecting a voter standard.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Constitution of 1787/1789 makes a distinction. When we're allocating representatives, we use total population with the proviso that slaves and others are considered three-fifths of a person. When we are considering who votes, we leave that to the states under the original Constitution with the proviso that, to oversimplify, if you can vote for the lower house of the state legislature, you can vote for Congress. But a state can say all white men can vote for the lower house, half of all white men whose names begin from A to K, or whatever.
Marcia, thanks for the call. Marcia called us on 410-662, 410-662-8780, and you can do that also, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here with Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law and Mark Graber of the University of Maryland School of Law. We're talking about the Supreme Court. Abortion rights are likely to come up in a case out of Texas.
Well, there's two cases, Texas and Mississippi, that have come out in slightly divergent ways. These are not cases that, as presently configured, would directly test Roe versus Wade. They have to do with state regulations that are being imposed on abortion facilities that are very, very burdensome, to the extent that they're putting a third or a half or two-thirds. In Mississippi, they would have put all the abortion clinics out of business. That have to do with saying, well, we think that abortion clinics, there something might go wrong, and so you need to have special equipment. You need to have halls that are wide enough that two emergency gurneys can go past each other. The doctors need to have admitting privileges in the nearby hospitals, which had never been required before, because if there is an emergency at a reproductive health care facility, as a matter of course, the emergency room will treat them. The doctor can call and say this is on their way. There's no question. So the thought is that the legislature, which is in both places sharply anti-abortion, has just imposed these restrictions in order to make it harder to run an abortion clinic. And it will be very interesting to see how the court tackles these restrictions.
So, I mean, it will be up to the court to basically decide whether or not these restrictions are indeed health related, which is how they were characterized by the legislatures.
Yes, and then they'll decide if they constitute what's called an undue burden on the right to choose.
Kirk in Towson has a question Kirk, welcome to the show.
Hi. Couple of questions. You know, Abraham Lincoln was a pretty good lawyer, and he was mostly self-taught. How can a citizen find precedence in the law? How can a citizen, you know, follow the citations that you see in precedence of law? Do you go to a public library or a law library? And if it's a law library, who has access to it?
I'll tell you the very first resource you should go to if you're wanting to follow the Supreme Court is SCOTUSblog.com, which has previews of every case. It has all the briefs for every case. And it has what's called argument in plain English, where they rewrite what a case is about for non-lawyers. And then if you get interested in the specific cases they're citing, most of them are online at this point. You can get the citations and type them into your Google box, and the text of the case will come up. So there's a world of information available right there. And remember, when CNN was spending 14 minutes telling the nation that Obamacare had been struck down, SCOTUSblog was right from moment one.
That's impressive. Who does SCOTUSblog?
It's run by Tom Goldstein of Goldstein and Russell, which is a Supreme Court law firm, but it's separate from the law firm and walled off, so it isn't really propaganda for his cases. It has Lyle Denniston, who has been covering the court since 1962.
I worked with Lyle Denniston at the Washington Star. He's still covering the court.
I saw him yesterday, and he remembers everything that's happened since 1962. He writes up summaries of a lot of the arguments. Amy Howe does that, and they're excellent. And the links are complete, so if you want to know more about a case, You can find it very easily.
We are down to our last few minutes, and I don't know whether you've been following this case with a local angle, Ocasio versus U.S. Ocasio.
Yes, this is what they call the Wire case, not because it's really about the Wire, but it could be an episode of the Wire. Officer Ocasio came to Baltimore from Puerto Rico, where he had been a policeman, got a job on the Baltimore Police Department, and he discovered that a place called Majestic Towing would pay police officers $150 to $300 to get accident-damaged cars towed to Majestic. Majestic, by law, was not supposed to have access to these cars, but this kickback scheme, which eventually involved dozens and dozens of BPD officers, was broken up by the FBI, and most of the officers took plea bargains. Very few of them served time, you know. But Officer Ocasio insisted on going to trial, and he was sentenced to 18 months. In prison, and he claims that his conviction was wrongly reached under a federal statute called the Hobbs Act, which makes it a crime to conspire to extort money from another.
And very briefly, why does he think that wasn't appropriate?
Because the extortion the government claims is the bribes that he was being paid by Majestic. And he says, that's not another. If it's a conspiracy, we're both in it. You can't extort yourself, basically. And so the legal issue is fairly recondite, but the facts are fabulous, and Baltimore people should be following it, absolutely.
Okay, we'll be watching for that. I want to thank you both for all you've given us to watch for. Mark Graber of the University of Maryland, Francis Kincarry School of Law, author of A New Introduction to American Constitutionalism, and Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore School of Law, Supreme Court correspondent for The Atlantic Online, contributing editor to The American Prospect, and author of American Justice 2014. I also want to thank Eddie Zabrolin Park for supplying lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads and specials each day, all listed on their website, which we have on our website. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. And tomorrow at noon, we'll hear about the top business stories of the week from a reporter at the Baltimore Business Journal, talk about the Goucher poll. Lots of news tomorrow. Tune in for Midday at noon. I'm Sheila Kast.